Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And this is Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Seriously. We're back at it again with the emails. So we've had this one from Theodora Danick, who says she's just left London for the North.
Yes.
And it's great to go on long walks with Seriously coming out of her headphones, which sounds really idyllic. And she says she was wondering if we'd ever watched Grantchester, a weird recent obsession of mine. In case you haven't heard of it, it's all on ITV and stars James Norton as a blindingly hot vicar with an expressive face. He solves crimes. It's also set in the 50s. Sounds twee and boring, but somehow it isn't. That's, I mean, a fairly good description of Grantchester, I think.
I've never seen it, but any description of anything that suddenly goes, he solves crimes, after some other tangential things, I'm totally here for it.
It's very much in that mould of, like, any TV show where you've watched it and been like, wait, you're not the police. Why are the police letting you be at this crime scene? Like, in Silent Witness, when the pathologists are just, like, visiting, like, the relatives of the deceased, and you're like, you're not allowed to do that. Why are you doing that? it's like that. He's the vicar, and weirdly, he's actually very much in the mould of the, like, female spinster busybody, and okay. He's, like, the single vicar in the town, except he's young and hot. And he just, like, gets overly involved in everyone's lives.
We've also had quite a few people get in touch after we talked a bit about Hamilton last week. As social media suggests, loads of you really, really like it. And you also responded to our call for help with understanding the adaptation. In particular, thanks very much to Claire, who got in touch to say that Lin-Manuel Miranda was inspired by Ron Chernow's biography, Alexander Hamilton, which would be a good place to start if you wanted to go in depth. I've also found that there's a whole active Hamilton fandom on Tumblr where lots of amateur historians have written up helpful background info. So thank you very much to Claire.
Oh, that's nice.
And then in response to your thing about saying that you're going to New York quite soon, but you're not sure you'll ever be able to see it because it's so busy, Kristen got in touch to say, I wanted to let you know that most of the Broadway shows in NYC offer ticket lotteries. Usually there's a set time on the day of the show where you need to show up and put your name in. In my experience, you don't have to wait around very long before you know if you've won. I was able to see the Book of Mormon several years ago when it was extremely popular by winning the ticket lottery.
Ah, that's a really good shout. I'll definitely give that a go.
Because we're actually both going to New York in the next couple of months. Not together, weirdly.
Although
we should be. I don't know why. So yeah, I think maybe we'll both have to give that a go and
definitely. See
if we can manage it.
Yeah, tell me how you fare.
But anyway, thank you very much to everyone who sent us links about that. We are still working on our Hamilton interest and we'll report back.
So just in case there was any doubt about what the first thing we're going to talk about this week is, we can tell you it is Lemonade. Lemonade is a 12-track visual album from the queen of music, art, and life, Beyoncé. It incorporates film, music, and spoken word to create a layered portrait of Black female identity. It's one of those things where it's like, where were you when Lemonade dropped? I had no idea that it was going to be an album. I woke up on Sunday morning sort of scrolling through my Instagram feed and I was looking at all these pictures that Amanda Stenberg had posted and I was like, these look really atmospheric and cool. And then I was like, oh my God, this is from a Beyonce album? What? What? And had to go and like watch it immediately. And it changed me. I don't know about you, but I was just like, wow, this is just one of the best things I've ever seen in my life.
It's completely stunning. I first similarly woke up on Sunday morning, scrolled through Twitter, and was like, why is everyone using the lemon emoji? What is happening? Is today lemon day? And I was like, in a sense, yes, today is lemon day. But not in the way I somehow thought it was to do with fruit. Yeah, it is extraordinary. And I haven't stopped thinking about it. Not least because of all of the stuff that's been talked about since, about is it about Jay-Z cheating on her? Mm. Is it not? What, you know, are all the lyrics about, you know, Becky with the good hair and stuff?
Yeah, yeah.
Refer to infidelity. What is it? Or is this another, like, Sasha Fierce style character mm-hmm. that she's adopting in maybe in a slightly more nuanced way? Or is this direct personal experience? I'm swinging to and fro on this. I don't know, A, what I think, and B, if I mind.
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the best things about this is sometimes when people release really, really good, you know, works of art, the first thing you want to think is like, oh my God, like, where has this come from? Like, what personal experience has it come from? And I think the best works of art make you just think like, do I care either way? Yeah. Like, either way, it's so brilliant that it doesn't really make a difference to how I feel about it. And I think the great thing about what she's done with this is, yes, it does get everyone talking and they are a bit like, oh my God, did Jay-Z cheat on Beyonce? Because we've got this whole album about basically the experience of being cheated on. So we start with suspicion and intuition, and we go on through anger and apathy to forgiveness and redemption. And so you get this really sort of detailed exploration of those feelings, but maybe they're symbolic and they stand for, you know, other sort of ways that you can be wronged by people. And I think that's what a lot of Black women have been saying, that it like relates to their experiences of being like sinned against by the world at large, as it were, and like how you can get over those kind of oppressions. But I remember like looking through my timeline when it came out, like all these like, oh, I think we can all agree that like Jay-Z's not been a good boy, or like, wow, this album is so personal, I feel like a voyeur. And I was like, really? From Beyonce? Because throughout the rest of her career, I think although everyone's been so interested in her personal life, we never really get much of it. Like Beyonce 2013, it's a really interesting album, and there's definitely lots like about her daughter in there. There's lots of little hints about like Blue, but apart from that, you don't really feel like you know much about her as a person.
No, she, I think almost more than any celebrity, has successfully perfected the art of the kind of arm's length access.
Yeah.
In that you feel like you get something of her. So I do, for instance, know what her daughter looks like, mm-hmm. but I don't know anything else about her daughter.
Yeah. You know? And she's not one of these celebrities who has like a really prominent social media presence and gives you lots of little sort of curated insights into her life either. You see her constantly. She's everywhere. And yet she's like nowhere at the same time. So I was surprised by those comments. And then when I watched the visual album, I was just like, oh my God, this is crazy. It feels so personal and so raw in that way. But maybe that's another game she's playing with us. Who knows, really?
Yeah, and there's also so many different modes in the same, I mean, it's just over an hour, the kind of film of it. From right at the beginning, where she's kind of completely triumphant in this amazing yellow dress, smashing stuff with a baseball bat. Which
it's like a gleeful anger. It's just so brilliant, isn't
it? It's so brilliant. It's so fantastic. Something don't feel right because it ain't right, especially coming up after midnight. I smell your secrets, and I'm not too perfect to ever feel this worthless. How did it come down to this? Scrolling through your call list. I don't wanna lose my pride, but I'ma fuck me up a bitch. Know that I kept it sexy, and know I kept it fun. There's something that I'm missing, maybe my head for one. What's worst? Looking jealous or crazy? Jealous or crazy? Or like being walked all over lately, walked all over lately. I'd rather be crazy. Hold up, they don't love you like I love you. Slow down, they don't love you like I love you. Back up, they don't love you. And then later on, she looks almost like physically smaller, but it's all part of the same narrative, like it moves from one to the other with these spoken word segments that I think are my favourite bits about it. And there are some great songs on the album that I'm definitely going to listen to over and over again, but these spoken word segments are beautiful.
I found that amazing as well. So these mostly are lifted from Warsan Shire poems, and she's like a London-based Somali heritage poet, and they're really, really intense, aren't they? They'll have lines in them like, if you really want, I'll wear her skin over mine.
I'll wear her hands as gloves.
Yeah, her teeth as confetti. And Beyonce, obviously, because she's so brilliant with her voice, the way she like handles words is amazing. So she'll like really spit the word teeth and you'll be like, oh, this is so intense. But they're really good, I think, at taking this very specific scenario that we're being presented chronologically of like woman suspects husband, discovers he's cheating on her, eventually forgives him. We've got that very specific narrative. These spoken word bits really lift it out of that specificity and like bring it into a much more like thematic and symbolic realm. There's a lot of stuff in the spoken word segments about like heritage and like tradition and stuff that's happened to your mother and father and how you can like inherit all those kinds of like emotional issues.
Yeah, family in the sense beyond just a couple is also quite a big theme. Like later on in the Beyonce Does Country song, Daddy Lessons, is all about that as well, isn't it? Relationship between parents and then relationship between daughter and parents.
Definitely. And there's like a thread in those spoken word bits which keeps coming round full circle. Shall we talk a bit about our personal favourites?
Yeah.
So what did you like best on the album?
I still really like Formation.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely good choice.
That's the final song on the album. Obviously, we have heard it before because of all its Black Lives Matter imagery. It prompted some pop culture reactions at the time, like that SNL sketch about how white people discovering Beyonce is black. So I suppose I hadn't really listened to Formation as a song again that recently.
Yeah.
And it's a really good song. So that, I think, for me, in a strong field, comes out top.
I think one of the things I liked so much about this album is that you do kind of have to listen to it like as a journey. I know that word is so annoying, but I love Hold Up, which is the baseball bat sunny angry song, and I also really love Freedom, which I actually think I prefer the film version of, because although this is a visual album, the album that you would like go and buy on iTunes is slightly different because it doesn't have those spoken word interludes. Like there's a guest verse from Kendrick Lamar on the album that's not in the video, and I think I love the video version of Freedom because you get Beyonce a cappella for like the whole first verse, and then suddenly all the rest of the music like comes in behind her and she's like tied to this sort of pole in front of an audience, sort of a cross between like Jesus on the cross and like a black person about to be hung. This really like powerful image, and then suddenly all this music comes up, and I think that is like one of the best bits on the whole album for me. And I also really love All Night, which is sort of the last song on the visual album, and then Formation plays over the credits after that, but it's sort of like the end to the visual album. And when I listened to that, I was like, oh my god, Beyonce is like Jesus. She's like spiritual, and it's because it's all about forgiveness, but as the one giving the forgiveness, and it feels really sort of like uplifting and weirdly like emotional. It makes me cry. I love it.
I read a really interesting piece on The Guardian contrasting Hillary Clinton in, you know, the late 90s and Beyonce now.
That's a stretch.
Which is a stretch in some senses, but they are both married to men in the public eye with a massive sort of professional reputation, and for a while were kind of second string to that. The author was kind of saying that this is a way of processing a transition of power within a relationship.
I feel like empowerment is such a slippery thing, and I think it's an overused word, but I found Lemonade to be so empowering. And I think it's specifically because the way that she's done this transition, and she really shows all the emotions through it, and you really get this like absolute peak of her anger before we get anywhere near acceptance and forgiveness. There's like a way of accepting love and like being a loving, forgiving person that's still grounded in self-love and self-respect. So you can have an album where she's like literally saying, you try this again, you lose your wife, you know I give you life. And that, which is just like an amazing thing to say, I give you life, you know. And she says that a few times, and then to go on from that and be like, yes, and I can forgive you, and I can, it's so not victim like at all. It's like the opposite of that, and I think that's perhaps the most amazing thing about this album, in taking that very like victim correlated narrative of being cheated on and like turning it around and making it something different.
There's no way you could watch or listen to this and think Beyonce lacks agency in the situation, right?
Absolutely.
Which is the part that's really exhilarating, that whatever's happened to her, she's making things, she's doing things, and she's talking about it.
True love never has to hide. Trying to touch you. Kiss up and rub up and fill up. Kiss up and rub up and fill up on you. Give you some time to prove that I can trust you. Again, I'm gonna kiss up and rub up and fill up. Kiss up and rub up and fill up on you all night.
So now we're going to talk about something a little different. Bake Off Creme de la Creme is a BBC Two spin-off from The Great British Bake Off, which we have talked about on the podcast before, and I sort of assume all listeners are familiar vaguely with what it's about. This one is presented by the chef Tom Kerridge and features teams of high-class patisserie chefs competing to make incredibly elaborate desserts under time pressure in the hall of a stately home.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very accurate description. It is ridiculous-looking desserts in a ridiculous-looking place with ridiculous time pressures.
They face grueling challenges.
Just be careful.
No, this is really hard in the mouth stuff.
And the toughest of judges.
It's meaningless to me. I cannot really mark that.
I made her cry.
Who will take their place in the semi-final and prove to be the creme de la creme?
Because you can't help thinking that maybe the chefs would fare better in trying to make these absurd things if they could do it in a real kitchen.
Yeah.
With real stuff. Instead of, because I suppose it is a feature of, I guess we must call it the Bake Off franchise, that, you know, in the amateur one, they do it in a tent, mm-hmm. in the garden. Mm-hmm. Obviously with real ovens and fridges and stuff, but, you know.
But they're in a marquee.
They're in a marquee. And there have been episodes where, like, people's ice cream cakes have just melted because it's summer. And now what they've done is install temporary professional kitchens in the hall of a massive stately home.
I think also, like, as the desserts get more elaborate and large scale, so too does the competition. And
yeah.
I find the structure of creme de la creme, like, much harder to comprehend, because it's not like the Bake Off where you have like 9 people and then once a week you lose yeah. someone. Like, the competitive hierarchy is like a lot more complicated.
It's a lot more like University Challenge, if anyone is as interested in that as I am.
Bake Off meets University Challenge.
No, it is, because in the sense that at the beginning of University Challenge there are dozens of teams, and so you might see a team like in the first week and then not see them again for like 3 months because they got through whatever that was, and then they had to play the whole rest of the round to find out who else is in it. And it's kind of a bit like that, isn't it? That
yeah.
like, you see a team in the first one and then there's like high scoring runners up and
exactly
yeah.
it's really complicated, and like the individual scoring is even more complicated, so each judge, like,
they just say numbers, they're just saying numbers.
Every round they'll do like 3 different things, and then they'll mark them on each of those out of 10 each a judge, so it, like, each dessert will get a possible 30 out of 30, which means they get a maximum of 90 points or something. But then, like, depends if they're doing like a big showstopper instead of 3 other things, and like it gets so complicated,
it's so complicated.
So quickly.
So yeah, the bit at the end where they obviously try and do the big tense build up to see who's going to get what score, and you can see all the contestants are doing like furious mental arithmetic. It does feel a little bit like Number Wang from that Michelin
yeah,
web.
Definitely.
You know, when they're just being like 17, that's Number Wang.
Yeah.
And you score 92, and then there's like a lull where everyone's like, Is that good or bad?
Good or bad, yeah.
Don't know. But to be fair, all of this just adds to its slightly weird charm, I think. So what do you think of Tom Kerridge as a presenter? Because, I mean, he's not Mel and Sue, crucially.
I don't like to unnecessarily comment on people's appearances, but Tom Kerridge used to be a lot fatter.
Yeah.
And I liked him like that.
Yeah, I think I read an article about it, though, that it was very important for his health that he lose a lot of weight, though.
Like, he looks a bit like a balloon that's like been popped for air. And he's like, I loved him when he was just like all cheerful Tom Kerridge looking, and now he looks like a bit more serious and a
yeah.
bit. But yeah, he's good, but the Tom Kerridge brand is like, I'm just a rough and ready guy making a pie, you know, quality British food
yeah.
for like normal British folk, and then like
surprisingly delicious because I'm a Michelin starred chef, but also I'm just a bloke with a pub.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then to see him on this like delicate French pâtissière
yeah.
context is a bit like, I mean, it's good because you want someone to contrast the 3 judges a bit,
who are all experts and really,
which is obviously what
stuff.
Mel and
yeah.
Sue do in the original Bake Off, but he just doesn't quite fit.
Yeah.
And like sometimes he'll be like asking them questions, and it's good to have someone who's like, what's that ingredient that you've just said, because no one knows what that is. Like, that's obviously good. Mm. But like, I feel like he just bothers them a bit.
Yeah, he does, because you can tell he, because it's, you know, he's not a pastry chef, but he is a chef. Mm. So you can tell, like, he's at least partly, I can make an intelligent, useful comment here. But also his role is, as you say, to stand in for the viewer and be like, what's gelatin though?
Mm.
And I feel like he's not quite striking the balance between those two things.
No, and sometimes he like gets right in there and he's like, oh, what are you doing over here? And they'll be like, oh my God, do not breathe. Like, this is very, very intense.
I'm painting
stuff.
A cake with a soluble powder. What do you think I'm doing?
Yeah. But I feel like it's Tom and the three judges who you really get to know in this series, because you just don't get to know the contestants
at
all.
They're not constant enough, are they? They go, which is a shame because, yeah, as most of our joy in various series of The Bake Off is the ongoing and developing characters,
yeah.
Isn't it? Like
the
week to week.
You can be like, that is classic Tamal behaviour.
Yes, or Norman. I bloody love Norman. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I miss Norman. You could do with a few Normans on the creme de la creme.
Yes, exactly. People who, instead of making like umpteen layers of special mousses, would
just
be like
a biscuit.
I made a biscuit. What's wrong with my biscuit?
Yeah. So what do you think of the judges?
I really like Cherish. She is, I think, a pastry chef herself, a very, very experienced one for lots and lots of fancy hotels and
stuff.
She
looks a bit like Edna Mode.
Yes, she does.
From The Incredibles.
And she's just very, very blunt and very like, I didn't really like it.
Yeah.
She says quite a lot. Or it just doesn't work. She also, at one point in an episode I watched, got a ruler out, measured several cakes and was like, you've got a difference of 0.4 of a centimetre between these cakes. That's unacceptable. I would accept 0.1. but no more.
I know, she's really, really, really picky. And I like her a lot, because sometimes she'll say things like, the colours don't sing to me. And you'll be like, okay, well, we'll just accept that. Like, at times she'll be very vague and like arbitrary and subjective with her criticisms, and other times it will be like, I've got my like magnifying glass out and I can see a tiny lump of gelatin here. Yellow card. I don't get the yellow card thing either.
Yeah, I don't know
they
that
can
is.
Give they can give yellow cards for some puddings. I don't know. This is an unsafe pudding. Yellow card.
Get off the pit.
Exactly, it's very weird.
It's really weird. Definitely the format of the show is not ideal, but I'm still really enjoying watching people stress out about making ludicrously complicated tiny cakes.
Yeah, and they do look amazing. Have you had any like favourite patisserie puddingy things that you've...
I was pretty excited. I think it was in episode 2, the bonsai trees out of chocolate.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
That was so exciting.
Amazing. So far liked it when they made a giant swan out of sugar.
That was good.
But
yeah.
It collapsed. It collapsed mid-judging.
Oh yeah, and they all leapt back as if it was going to fall on them.
And then the judges were like, we'll just like, we won't downgrade you on that, we'll pretend that didn't happen. And I was like, what? Wait, what? Like,
yeah,
their display pudding wouldn't have lasted the party. That's definitely, you should definitely knock that down. Some of the flavours are weird as well. Like, they keep talking about classic flavour combinations, and I'm like, is that classic? Like, they'll be like, ah, strawberry and balsamic, a classic flavour combination, or like, ah, tonka bean and...
in yuzu.
Yeah, exactly.
The fuck is yuzu?
I don't know. They're like such weird ingredients, and yet they act as though they're like the staples of patisserie cooking, and maybe they are.
Maybe they
what
are.
What would I know?
But we don't do patisserie. Very occasionally we eat it.
What is a tonka bean? I'm dying to know.
But it is a joyful programme.
Yeah, definitely.
You cannot get away from that. I am intrigued to know whether they're going to franchise this one abroad in the way they have with
the Bake Off.
With the main Bake Off.
We had a great piece, didn't we, on like all the different international versions of the Bake Off.
And how weird it is that like in America, for instance, you win money if you win the Bake Off.
Yeah.
Whereas in Britain, obviously, you just win like a nice apron and the pride of being a winner.
Becoming a national treasure of Britain.
Yes.
Like, oh, Nadia.
Incidentally, have you seen? They've announced what her first TV show is going to be called.
Oh.
The Chronicles of Nadia.
Oh, that is so good. So she gets her own TV show.
Yeah,
no one's had that before, have they?
I don't think so, no.
Oh, that's really exciting.
Yeah.
Nation's sweetheart. Mm-hmm. Can't wait.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom,
like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Last week, I recommended that Caroline watch Zodiac, a 2007 film by David Fincher, exploring the real investigation into the notorious serial killer who called himself the Zodiac. It's based on the book of the same name by Robert Graysmith, a newspaper cartoonist here played by Jake Gyllenhaal.
Dear editor, this is the murderer of the two teenagers last Christmas at Lake Herman and the girl on the 4th of July.
I want you to print this cipher on the front page of your paper.
He wants his code in the afternoon edition.
Graysmith, don't you have a cartoon to finish?
The Zodiac Killer has come to San Francisco.
Another letter. School children make nice targets.
He gave himself a name.
Greek, Morse code, astrological signs. This guy's used them all.
I like killing people because man is the most dangerous animal of all.
How does one do that?
I like puzzles. I do them a lot.
And he basically gets all caught up in the investigation, doesn't he, Caroline?
Yeah, he does. So he is the main protagonist, right? Mm-hmm. In that there are other important characters, another journalist played by Robert Downey Jr., who's like a crime reporter at the same newspaper. Mark Ruffalo plays the main detective.
We love Mark guy. Ruffalo as a newspaper, not newspaper, but as a general crime investigating.
Yeah, I think as you said last week when you were introducing this, there are strong parallels with Spotlight.
Yeah, I felt nobody really said that when Spotlight came out, though, but when I watched it, I was like, oh, this reminds me so much of Zodiac. Obviously, they are quite different films in that this is really like thriller.
Yeah, it's a thriller, but I totally got what you meant when we talked about Spotlight, about how immersed in the dated world of it it feels, but they are similarly complete in their realization of the period, and also feature Mark Ruffalo investigating something. So maybe this is his like best acting mode.
I think it might be. I really enjoyed him in this anyway.
But yeah, the Jake Gyllenhaal character is the main one, even though he is for much of it sort of on the fringes of the investigation, because he's a cartoonist at the paper. He's not one of the reporters. He's not like in all the meetings with the police. It's only at the end, once Robert Downey Jr.'s character, the reporter, has kind of burned out and gone to live on a boat and drink himself to death, that he picks up the mantle of trying to investigate this case and actually find out what happened, and he writes a book, which this film is based on.
Yeah.
I had heard of the Zodiac Killer through people saying that it was Ted Cruz.
Yeah, that's so funny to me.
I did not know what it was, other than a kind of historic serial killer thing in America
some time ago. I think the window into the sort of obsession angle of this film comes in when Robert Graysmith ends up in a sort of meeting about the Zodiac Killer, and there's this piece of code, and that's what I think captured most people's interest in the Zodiac case, is that he basically writes this piece of like code or like secret language detailing an element of the, what is it, an element of the crime, or just like,
it's like a message. So he, after every murder,
he
sends this picture cipher to different newspapers with a demand that they print it, and when they decipher it, it's always like a new threat.
Targeting school children is fun, or something horrible like that. The way Robert Graysmith sort of gets involved is that he loves doing puzzles, and when he sees this sort of puzzle, as it were, in the meeting, he like copies it down and becomes really, really obsessed with trying to figure it out. And it's sort of that meeting point of already interesting unsolved crime and weird puzzle.
Weird
I think captured a lot of imaginations at the time.
And also I think the sort of randomness of it, in that they do latterly try and piece together some connections between their main suspect and the people who were murdered, but until they get to that point, it just seems totally random. The actual people who get murdered, or in some cases really badly injured, they just seem to be in the right place. It's more like the time and the place is what's important to the murderer, not the person or the type of person.
Exactly. And it's weirdly motiveless.
Yeah, so it it's not all women, it's not all black people, it's not all anybody, it's not all people of a particular profession. They happen all over California. It's not even people from the same town.
Yeah.
It's just random. And I think that's possibly what got the kind of public hysteria going, is that if there is just some nutter going around randomly stabbing people in the street,
of course you're going to be terrified.
Of course you're going to be terrified. Whereas at least you can be like, oh, this is someone who attacks children. I'm not a child, therefore I am less worried about this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so in the film, some of the portrayals of the actual murders are quite scary. I found them really quite horrifying.
Yeah, definitely.
But that, I think, is partly what lifts the film beyond the realms of being a kind of crime procedural film, mm-hmm. and that it becomes a proper thriller, mm-hmm. because it's properly cinematic in the way, like, right at the very beginning, for instance, when you see two people who you're pretty sure are victims in a car, mm-hmm. and they've, like, gone to a sort of remote makeout place, and then this car comes up behind them, and you just see the lights, and then it goes away again, and then it comes back again, and then someone gets out and comes around the side of the car and just starts shooting them. That is really horrifying.
It stops it from being, like you say, just about the sort of investigation side of things, because that threat is very real the entire time, because like, he could be anyone, and he does seem to be doing stuff at random. So I think you feel really pulled through the plot of this film.
But it is ultimately the obsessive nature of the various characters involved, I think, that keep you watching it. We had an email from a listener in advance of us discussing Zodiac, actually, which
very organized,
Melissa, thank you very much. The email subject is just, yay, you picked Zodiac! ! So clearly a fan of the film. But she makes a really interesting point, which is, she said, I think what pushes Zodiac above other typical serial killer films is how, rather than focusing on trying to catch the killer, although there is plenty of that, Zodiac is more interested in examining the theme of obsession, whether it's Mark Ruffalo's obsession as an officer trying to catch the bad guy, Robert Downey Jr.'s obsession as a reporter trying to break a good story, or Jake Gyllenhaal's obsession with just wanting to know who Zodiac is. If Zodiac could be defined by one scene, it would be the scene where Jake Gyllenhaal learns that the Zodiac killer has been taking credit for crimes he didn't commit. The realization that Zodiac is not who he thought. Robert Downey Jr. notes, you almost look disappointed.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is really, really interesting, because there is some of that, I think, in the latter part of the film, when Jake Gyllenhaal's character goes from being this slightly naive passenger in the whole thing. The joke is that everyone calls him Boy Scout, you know, because he's so, like, clean living and boring. And just wants
and
to
he's like Eagle Scout, actually.
And just wants to help people, you know. When he goes from that into becoming a proper obsessive with the case and starts properly reporting it and really putting himself and his family in considerable danger to do so. And, like, his wife leaves him and takes their kids, and, like, his life kind of goes to shit a bit through his own actions. And that's when you realise that, obviously, he's not a serial killer, he's not done anything as bad, but the person who committed these crimes is affecting him. He's so obsessed with finding out who it is that he's willing to put all these other things on hold or even sacrifice them for it.
Yeah, I think that Robert Downey Jr. line is really interesting about, oh, you almost look disappointed. And this is something that I feel like I think about so much at the moment. When we did Making of a Murderer on the podcast, I wrote a piece about that afterwards, about how people become so obsessed with, like, proving a specific narrative right, rather than, like, the general sort of broader questions of, like, you know, police conduct and these kinds of things, which are probably the real issues of Making a Murderer. Instead, everyone's like,
did he do it or not?
Did he do it or not? Well, or, like, he was framed in this specific way, they did this with the blood, or what about the payphone at the Best Buy, you know, these kinds of things. And I've been watching the People versus OJ Simpson American Crime Story. In that, it's very much, you know, you see the joy on the defense's face when they get OJ off, and even though you know that some of them have their doubts about whether he actually is innocent or not. And this idea that, you know, the thing that's really important is the story, which is what so many people feel in this in different ways, is so interesting to me, and often seems to be, like, what clouds some of the real issues at the heart of, like, true crime stories.
Yeah, exactly. And that definitely happens with the Zodiac story as well, because they eventually, partly through the Robert Graysmith character's efforts, they get to the point where they've got a main suspect and enough evidence to get a proper warrant and all of this kind of stuff. And then the guy has a fatal heart attack before they can interview him again. So even if that was him, there's no way of ever knowing. So the story doesn't have an ending.
Yeah, exactly. And that's really unsatisfying
in
a lot of ways. Wouldn't it be a lot more fun if, for example, presidential candidate Ted Cruz was the Zodiac killer? You know what I mean? Like, there is, obviously that is always a joke, but there is something about these cases where the detail can become so thrilling that people really want to have that pieced together exact narrative of what actually happened. And to an extent, that's always going to be futile.
Yeah.
So depressing.
Yeah, it kind of is depressing. Anyway, for next week, I'm going to recommend you something that I find really joyful.
We need some joy.
Which is a TV series from quite a long time ago now, The West Wing.
Oh, I've heard a lot about The West Wing, obviously. though I have never even watched a minute of it.
Now, I'm a bit older than you. The West Wing was a massive deal when I was at university. Mm. I think it had probably passed over. The period that it came out was right at the end of the Clinton era and then during the George W. Bush era. There were 7 years, seven series. I watched it at the end of the Bush era, running into Obama.
Mm.
So even people who had no kind of academic or professional interest in American politics were experts on American politics at that time. So it kind of followed that your pop culture should reflect that.
Mm.
I'm going to recommend you the very first episode,
Wicked,
of The West Wing, and to accompany it, The West Wing Weekly, which is a new podcast that tracks each episode. They watch an episode a week and then they talk about it in lots of detail. One of the guys who does it is a cast member from The West Wing, although he's not in it.
Cool.
He's not in it until season four, so you won't actually see him for ages, but he's also just clearly...
He's just like nobly like, don't remember any of this, but...
He's the biggest fan.
Oh, that's good.
He's friends with Aaron Sorkin.
Okay,
and had been for a long time before Aaron Sorkin started making The West Wing. So he was involved in the personal life of the screenwriter, and then he was in the show later on.
Mm-hmm.
They recap and they discuss, and they have various guests on, other cast members and stuff.
The perfect companion.
It's a great companion. So I think if you are watching it sort of out of context years later, that's a good way to do it.
Oh, I'll enjoy that. Thank you. Thanks for listening to Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to Seriously. All you have to do is search SRSLY in iTunes or any other podcasting app you use. While you're there, it would be really great if you could leave us an iTunes review, as it helps other people find the show.
We also rely on you listeners for your recommendations, so if you want to tell us what you thought about something, or if you've got something we should watch, you can contact us on Twitter, Facebook, via email. All the details are on seriouslypodcast.com. If you like, you can also recommend us to your friends, family, neighbours, strangers. Let them know that you like the podcast and that they should be listening to it too.